the Outrider Podcast.
All right, welcome to episode 8 of the Outrider Podcast. I am Jason Quinn-Mallott, your technically frustrated host. I've been trying to get this introduction onto Colin's conversation here and just can't seem to get it right. I either can't breathe, I hyperventilate, I don't know what the problem is with this particular introduction. Oh, and then one time the introduction disappeared, and that happened to be the episode, the version of the episode that I released this morning. So I'm putting in this introduction now, and really just what feels natural is to complain about this shit. Because I am a novice, and I still continue to get things wrong. If I had the money, I would hire someone to do some of the more important stuff, so that I could just babble uncontrollably, like I'm doing now. Anyway. So before I get to my conversation with Colin, let me say that I do have a wish list of writers I would like to get to. A lot of them I sort of already know in one fashion or another, but eventually that little list is going to run out. So if there's a writer you think I should talk to or think you would like to hear from, whether I'm talking to them or not, let me know. Maybe I can get in touch with that writer, or you could help me get in touch with that writer, or help that writer get in touch with me. However it works, maybe what I need to do is hire a PR person. I don't know. Anyway. Okay, so Colin Dickey. He is the author of two wonderfully bizarre nonfiction books. His first was Craniocleptie, Grave Robbing, and The Search for Genius. His second is The Afterlives of the Saints, Stories from the Ends of Faith. Both are from Unbridled Books. Now, Colin and I first met in about 2009 online, just after our books were published. And we've tried unsuccessfully several times to meet face-to-face, and it never just quite worked out. Until he decided to move across country with his wife from L.A. to New York. And they made a little side trip to my rundown little hometown here, and we got to meet in person. The plan had been to record the podcast then, but we were having just a little bit too much fun drinking wine, eating dinner, and entertaining our more attractive partners. Anyway, so this is our recording several weeks later. So hope it goes well. I'm going to shut up now and let's get to Colin, because who knows what else will go wrong, technically, sonically, personally, metaphysically, spiritually, technology. Man, if there were any better way to do this, I would do it, but I don't know. And you just need to practice more. Spend more time doing whatever. I'm reading a book. Maybe it'll help. All right, let's get to Colin Dickey, and I'll shut up now.
Hello?
Hello, sir.
Hey, how's it going?
Not too bad. How are you?
I'm good. Can you... Oh, there it goes. All right.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, this will be fun.
Cool.
Oh, do you have a beer?
I don't. It's a little early for me. I'll just get sleepy if I drink now. So, I also just came from brunch, so I'm already
full up to the gills.
Yeah, but I'll be fine. Yeah, I'll. Is the audio okay? Do I need to be on a headset or anything?
Not unless you're comfortable with it. I do it just so that I can hear everything, because I'm, you know, recording and trying to manage all of that.
Okay. Yeah. No. Just let me know if you. Need anything?
No, so far it sounds good.
Okay, cool.
So, Colin, how's New York treating you?
New York is treating me well. I mean, I'm excited about fall. Coming from a land that has no seasons. I must say, it's cold, but I like it. So, yeah.
Getting used to, well, they have subways and things in Los Angeles, didn't they?
They do. I mean, the subways are actually getting much better than they were, though I didn't really use the subways a lot in LA. But no, I mean, I love the idea of being able to read on a commute, which is just perfect. So yeah, so I'm digging that.
Now, you're originally from San Francisco, correct?
San Jose, which is about an hour south of San Francisco. So yeah, close enough.
So still the Bay Area.
The Bay Area, yes.
Indeed. Is that what they call it?
They do. They do.
Yeah. What was it like growing up there?
It's pretty boring. I mean, I grew up in a kind of, you know, suburban kind of environment. The actual town is called Sunnyvale. It was across the street from Apple's headquarters, or across the freeway, as it were. So, yeah, I mean, growing up was pretty boring. I mean, it, like, in retrospect, I mean, there was, you know, like, there's a lot of great sort of natural areas around there, you know, the Santa Cruz Mountains. And I spent a fair amount of time there. I probably could have spent more, and that maybe would have made it seem a little less boring. But, yeah, I don't know. I didn't have a bad childhood. I didn't have a particularly interesting childhood. So, yeah.
What did your parents do?
My parents both, one way or another, worked in high tech. So they both came to the Bay Area in the late 60s and kind of rode that early tech wave, more or less. So worked in computer companies and tech startups, you know, throughout the 70s and 80s. And then at some point, my mother was about 50. She went back to law school and got a law degree. So now she does law. But yeah.
Like IP law or?
Yeah. Like corporate contracts and things like that. So.
Oh, okay. Wow. So how did you become a writer?
How did I?
Was there a family obsession with books, or was it kind of a rebellious thing?
No, they were both. Both my parents were both readers, although not writers in any way, shape, or form. I sort of fell in love with it around junior high, I guess. I was mostly reading a lot of Stephen King, and my brother was a musician, and I was either going to be a musician or a writer. And the thing about being a writer is that you didn't have to collaborate with anybody else. You could just be by yourself. And because I was terrible at collaborating, and you know, nobody would form a band with me, then writing kind of went out by default. So.
I think we have more similarities than we originally thought, because my big thing was Stephen King when I was in high school.
Oh, right. Okay.
And yeah, and I have conflicting emotions about Stephen King anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yes.
What are those?
Well, you know, there are a few things that he does incredibly well.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of often think of him the same way as I do of Philip Dick, who wrote so much that it just appears to be wildly uneven from one book to the next.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I think if you like his early stuff is pretty consistently interesting, and then it drops off. I don't know, probably about the time he stopped doing cocaine. So probably around, you know, you know, the late 80s, it started to get kind of all over the place. And that's about when I stopped reading much of it anyway. So, yeah. So.
Yeah. The last one I really read was, The Dark Half.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know, just kind of went off the rails after that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Were you big into sports at all?
No, I have,
not at all.
No, I have, flat feet, and I have, no depth perception. So, Any sport that involves running and/or trying to get a ball or other object into a specific place is pretty much a non-starter for me. So I'm okay at bowling, and that's about as good as it gets.
Yeah.
Yeah, why were you into sports?
Oh, yeah. I think I didn't want to well, I grew up wanting to be the quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys and or play baseball, all of which I was done with by the time I finished my freshman year of high school. And then I went off and joined the girls' volleyball team and auditioned for my first play.
Wait,
And then,
how does that work? How do you join the girls' volleyball team?
well, in the 80s in Kansas, there was no guys, even intramural or interscholastic volleyball team. And my freshman year of high school, I had compressed a disc in my lower back because I always wanted to be a quarterback. And moving to a brand new high school, they stuck me out as wide receiver just because they didn't know what to do with me. And I was never very good at blocking. And, I speared a guy and compressed a disc in my lower back. So I stopped playing football, but couldn't get out of the habit of doing something in the fall. So I thought, I like volleyball. I'll go out for the girls' volleyball team.
Cool.
Made the JV team.
Oh, how to work for
Well, I had a whole lot of fun. It was nice being the only guy on the bus to away games. But of course, I'd get back to school, and all the wrestlers and the football players decided that between the girls' volleyball team and theater, they were sure I was gay.
So it happens.
Yeah. But I was the only guy on a bus full of girls, and theater girls are weird.
Maybe just best to leave it at that.
Maybe so. So, where was it that you ended up doing your undergraduate, and what were you majoring in?
I majored in creative writing because at that point I definitely wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to go to the Pacific Northwest because I wanted to be where it rained a lot, because it doesn't rain in San Jose hardly ever. So I basically just looked around for a liberal arts college in the Pacific Northwest that had a creative writing major, and I ended up at a place called Pacific University, which is most well known for its optometry program. But it had a creative writing degree. The guy who the poetry professor, who was this sort of classic piece of work, who wore every day a black t-shirt tucked into blue jeans with a brown sports coat, which he wore single day, like a uniform, like pretty much universally. I never ever saw him in anything different. He just had a closet full of black t-shirts and jeans, and wrote really terrible poetry. And now is has sort of reinvented himself as a taker of softcore, quote unquote, erotic photography, which is god awful in so many problematic ways.
It's not of his students, is
No, not of his students.
it?
No, but he's of that kind of, he sees himself of that late 60s sort of Woody Allen European cinema. It's kind of sleazeball kind of artist type, and it's not of his students. But the depressing thing is he got like a grant from the university to make these things, and they're just
Wow.
indefensible, and it really killed my love of my alma mater. So yeah, our creative writing program, such that it was not perhaps among the finest. I guess we could put it that way. So there was a fiction writer there, who's now actually somewhat famous, who sort of wrote in a more kind of avant-garde, post-feminist, Kathy Acker kind of style. And I think a lot of us ended up writing like that just because we didn't want to write like the creepy poet dude. So, yeah, that was my undergraduate creative writing career. It's pretty marginal, I guess.
Who was the fiction writer?
Her name is Lydia Yuknovich. She toiled in obscurity, I guess, for years, and then a couple of years ago released a memoir that was widely well received, The Chronology of Water, I think it's called, is now somewhat of a she's well known in certain crowds, I guess. She hasn't reached the sort of Cheryl Strayed level of fame, but she kind of moves in those circles. So she left that place around the same time I did. So
so what kind of stuff were you writing then?
Well, I was writing sort of, I guess I would have defined it as transgressive fiction. It was pretty terrible. You know, and again, I mean, because in the Pacific Northwest, you could write poems about old growth forests and salmon while wearing a down vest. That was kind of the dominant mode. You know, and then this woman Lydia Yuknovich came along, and she was writing sort of sexually explicit, postmodern, sort of critically engaged, you know, citations of Deleuze and Guattari and Foucault, and it just was, you know, so radically unlike anything else that, you know, that's what everybody tried to imitate. So so most of the people I knew, most of the writers, the undergraduate writers, we all wrote some form of that, one version or another. So
is that why you stopped writing fiction eventually?
No, I mean, I, you know, I, so I got out of Oregon and I went to CalArts in LA, you know, which is known for its sort of avant-garde tradition. And I thought I would just be writing more of that, that crap. And I sort of, you know, went from being a medium-sized fish in a small pond to, you know, being a tiny fish in a huge pond. And I just remember everybody's reaction to sort of, well, isn't that sort of quaint how transgressive you think you're being? And which they were absolutely right, because, you know, you're like, yeah, this is really dangerous because I'm writing about sex. It's amazing, you know, and people are just like, yeah, that's not, you know, great for you. So so I, you know, I adjusted myself, but I mean, I was still writing fiction well up until a couple of years ago. It wasn't until, you know, my first book that somebody said, you know, can you write this nonfiction book instead? And so, so after that first book, that kind of ended my fiction career. I still kind of toy with going back to it, but it's been going on 5 years now, and I haven't gotten around to writing fiction again. So that's about where it's at.
So how did you get that first project, Craniocleptic? Was that
so what happened was I had written a piece for Cabinet magazine for their Bones issue on Thomas Brown's skull. I'd actually written a longer piece on Thomas Brown's skull and Joseph Haydn's skull and Goya's skull, and you know, it was about 7 or 8 pages, and they cut it down to a page just on Thomas Brown. You know, they were going to reject it flat out because they had somebody else who was writing on Thomas Brown's skull, but at the last minute, that person didn't quite, couldn't get his act together. So they turned to me instead because, you know, I'd basically already written it. You know, the history of how his head was stolen and, you know, passed around for about 100 years, by collectors and museums and stuff like that. So, so that piece happened in the winter of 2008 and, the editor at Unbridled Books, Fred Ramey, contacted me and you know, just out of the blue asked me, you know, if there was a manuscript involved and would I be interested in it. And I was, you know, at the time I was like, yeah, of course there's a manuscript, even though there was 8 pages. So that's how that happened. Basically, I'm a really scatterbrained person. And I'm, I got a head full of ideas that are driving me insane. And there's always 8 or 9 projects that I want to be working on. And, so I do best when somebody comes along and says, this is the project you need to be writing right now. And, you know, that's what happened with Fred, where he basically said, you know, write this book and I'll publish it. And so,
nice.
And he did. So, yeah, so that worked out well.
Okay. I have a question. It's going to seem kind of out of left field, but I promise I'll try to tie it all back in together.
Sure.
We got started talking originally because of a shared affinity for Michael Ondaatje. Mm-hmm. When did you start reading him?
So I started reading Ondaatje. There was this really fruitful time in my life when I was expertly judging books by their covers. I think like in the early 90s, it suddenly book covers became really interesting. I think a lot of that had to do with Chip Kidd, who designed, the paperback, or I guess the hardcover too, of The English Patient, the sort of earliest cover, the sort of figure walking through the snowstorm or sandstorm. And in the same bookstore over like three different runs, I picked up Kenzaburo Oe, Teach Us to Outgrow Our Madness, Ben Okri, The Famished Road, and Michael Ondaatje's The English Patient. So the O's were a particularly fruitful part of the alphabet for me. And, I fell in love with all three of those books, all of which had really interesting covers, and just kind of went there. But so I was probably 16 or 17 when I read The English Patient for the first time.
Oh, wow. Okay. Who were some of your other, who were your guys? I mean, who are the ones the writers that you go to and you look for solutions, for inspiration? Who are the ones that, you know, you kind of picked up and went, aha, that's what I want to do. This is.
Well, for fiction, it was often Ondaatje. Right now for nonfiction, with nonfiction, it's a little bit stranger because I'm often sort of redefining the tone and the structure depending on what the subject matter is. And so, so for right now, I'm writing a couple sort of more kind of essayistic, kind of more slightly poetic things. And I'm relying a lot on, I mean, those kinds of things. I rely a lot on Ann Carson's essays, on Ulibis, John DeGatta, Maggie Nelson, people like that. Mm-hmm. But I'm also writing a really more sort of straightforward journalistic piece. And for that, I'm reading whatever sort of, long form journalism I can find in, Wired and, longform.org and stuff like that. So I kind of, for each kind of piece, I kind of figure out what kind of guide I need for that piece. And then I go about kind of assembling a little roster of books that I'll dip into while I'm working on a given piece. So.
Sounds like a lot of research as you're running.
Well, it's sort of like, for the first book, for Craniocleptic, I used Eric Larson's The Devil in the White City quite a lot, which I didn't quite like very much when I first read it years ago. It was okay, but it was was when I sort of was like, okay, I need a good kind of model for a kind of historical true crime thing, and I went back to it, and I just kept returning to it. I kept thinking, this is the kind of voice that I wanted to do, and this is, the way he is able to use his sources to tell stories seemed really, really interesting. So I sort of kept going back to him. So, it's pretty impressionistic. I'll write until I get stuck, and then I'll sort of like fish around for somebody who maybe has a solution for whatever problem I'm in. Mm-hmm.
Why such strange topics, Colin? Skull theft, bizarre freaky saints.
You know, I mean, these are the things that, you know, that... So, okay, so... partly, I think I get attracted to things that are the things that get swept under the rug. I mean, you know, right. the story of Haydn's skull got stolen is a pretty well-known story. I mean, well-known more or less. I mean, the guy who stole Haydn's skull, you know, kept a pretty clear diary of it. You know, it's well-known. If you pick up any biography of Joseph Haydn, you'll find references to it in the, you know, in the final chapter and the postscript or something like that. But it's always a sort of thing that's sort of swept under the rug and a sort of an embarrassment. And so I think that I am drawn to those things that nobody wants to talk about, precisely because I think in those things we find a kind of an interesting way of getting at culture from an unexpected point of view. I mean, I don't want to write about, you know, Lincoln or, you know, World War II or something like that. I'm much more interested in, you know, these kind of hidden stories that are kind of hiding in plain sight. And so, so I get, you know, I mean, the same thing with the weird Catholic saints. I mean, you know, religion is everywhere. Discourses about religion are everywhere, but they tend to follow a very prescribed pattern. Right. And meanwhile, you know, you have these stories of guys who lived on top of poles for, you know, 37 years at a time, you know, as a testament to their faith, and, you know, people drinking the pus of lepers, and, you know, people having dreams in which, you know, Juliana Norwich having a dream in which Jesus proposes marriage to her and gives her as a wedding ring his foreskin, and, you know, just sort of like, you know, things that are there that just nobody wants to talk about. And I, you know, I mean, that's what I want to talk about. So that's the kind of thing that I end up getting drawn back to over and over again. I don't know. Where do you get your, what about you? Where do you get your topics? What leads you to write about a certain thing?
Well, I find that actually this is something that I've come to just recently. As I've been struggling ever since I've come back to Wichita to get a manuscript that finished that I am comfortable with, that I like in some way, is that when I was out in Colorado, I was able to detach myself from my personal history in a way. And so I was able to write something that was completely outside of myself. That was where I wanted to be. It was... And I wasn't worried about it. I came back here to Wichita, and every time I sit down to write, it wants to be incredibly personal.
Okay.
It wants to be about, you know, something that I experienced, something going on with my family, and I hate semi-autobiographical fiction. Well, hate might be a bit too strong of a word. I find that, well, like in... when I was in graduate school, one of the problems a lot of people had was separating the facts from the truth.
Right.
When they were writing fiction. And so they would write a short story that was ostensibly fiction and bring it into the class. And then they would try to defend it as, well, this is how it actually happened. And it's like, you're not concerned with how the events actually played out.
Right.
You can do whatever you want with them. Just stay true to that emotional core. That's more important.
Right.
And every time and part of the reason I felt so free and getting away from the personal stuff in Colorado was that I didn't have to worry about it. None of that was personal. None of that came from my life. I could make it whatever I wanted. You know, so I come back here and I've saddled myself with this giant epic about my grandfather and my father and I don't know. They say that, you know, when it's painful and frightening, that's where you should be.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I don't know how to feel about that right now. So, yeah, that's kind of where it comes from. And I also like to pull stuff out of some nugget out of history.
Yeah. Right. This is similar, right?
kind of like what Ondaatje does.
Yeah.
And because I hate it when people whose writing I like give up on some aspect of their writing, here's where we're going to loop it back in.
Yeah.
You've got this history obsession, particularly freaky, bizarre
Yeah.
parts of history.
Yeah.
You're deeply inspired by Ondaatje, who loves to pull stuff out of history.
Right.
Maybe you could com maybe this is your little sign. You're combining these interests. See how transgressive you get then. Or where do you what did you tend to end up where did your fiction go when you were writing it?
God, not terribly interesting places. I mean, the thing for me about fiction, this is very much me, so I don't, I mean, I got to a point where, I wanted to engage in these kind of philosophical ideas, and I thought that the way to do that was through fiction. You sort of put these philosophical ideas in the voices of your characters and have them sort of play off of each other. And so that's what I would try and do, and I'd kind of try and kind of engage these questions through some sort of enigmatic scene or discussion or something like that. And when I switched to writing nonfiction, I basically got to the point where I was like, oh, I could just engage in these conversations and these discussions. I don't have to hide behind anything. I mean, certainly, I've just never been great at creating character or plot. And I know that, there's a lot of great fiction that involves neither of those two things. But those are helpful things to have in nonfiction, and I just I or in fiction, and I just those are just two of my weaknesses, as it were. So, to be writing fiction with a real kind of paucity of character and plot just made it harder to get at those philosophical questions. And then I found that you could just ask those straight out in nonfiction without having to worry about plot and character, and it just made it significantly easier for me to deal with. So, yeah. So that's, yeah. I mean, I've of course drawn to Ondaatje for his use of the past, but I mean, I'm just as happy with his, a book like The Cat's Table, which doesn't necessarily involve the past. I mean, I think with somebody like Ondaatje, it's much more about his language and his voice, first and foremost. So yeah, so I don't know that.
Yeah, I find when I try to actually have a conversation about the philosophy of something, I end up talking myself in circles and wandering down, blind paths and rabbit holes and get lost. And it's easier for me to act out the issues, have characters play out whatever stuff, and not really consciously say this character is going to be, the cynic and embrace this idea and work that out, but more just kind of, I don't know, taking what I understand about stuff, which isn't much, and seeing what happens when it comes up against something else that I don't understand too much about. And maybe in that course I can figure something out, but who knows?
Right.
It's all muddling around in the dark with a broken flashlight for me.
Yeah.
So,
I
I
mean, no, it's
don't
true. I mean, that's what fiction lets you do that I think is really interesting. I do, again, I think that there are certain sort of problems or issues or discussions that work way better precisely because of that,
know.
Because you're not bound by coming up with an answer per se. That's why, I was trying to be sort of, not come out and sound as though, that I'm denouncing fiction or anything like that. It's just, for me, for right now, those set of questions that I'm most interested in right now don't require that scaffolding. And so that is that's what I'm working forward to right now. So yeah.
What are you working on next? You said you have a lot of different things going on.
Yeah, most I'm trying to keep it restricted right now. I'm mostly writing about ghosts and ice, kind of the two topics. So I spent 2 weeks in the Arctic this summer. So I'm still putting together pieces related to that. Two have come out, two are forthcoming, and I'm working on the last two probably. So I'll end up with six essays about this this trip to the ice. And then I've had a longer project working on haunted houses and haunted spaces for a while. And I keep coming back to that sort of in and out, not as concerted an effort as I'd like, but it's slowly moving towards something with that one. So
how did your trip to the Arctic come about? I mean, was that just a personal thing, or was this part of a contract or an assignment? No,
it's an artist residency. They take 26 artists and writers out on a boat, in the Svalbard archipelago, which is about 1,000 miles north of Europe. And, for 2 weeks, you sail up and down, the coast of Svalbard. And, I saw a post for it, and I absolutely just decided without any hesitation that it was something that I wanted to do. So I, applied, and then I had to, I had to raise cash to do it. But, but it was great. It was absolutely amazing. It was 2 weeks with 25 other, mostly artists, some sculptors, some photographers, about six other writers, one of whom just won the Giller Prize, which is the Canadian Pulitzer.
Right. Nice.
Yeah, so that was great for her. Yeah, we just sort of, we trekked up the coast up to the north end of Spitsbergen, which is the main island there. And we would make these kind of forays on the land every day using, Zodiacs, those little inflatable, kind of reinforced rafts with outboarders, right. And,
commando boats.
Yeah. No, it was great. Yeah. No, dismount on the shore and, that whole thing. So it was really beautiful. It was just a stunning landscape, and it's been really fruitful for what I'm working on and kind of working through some questions about, the past and mm-hmm. history. So that's a lot of what I've been doing lately. So yeah.
So the Museum of Banishment was your fundraiser for that.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, because I had to figure out some way to make enough money to cover the trip, because it wasn't free. And so I offered a chance for people to banish something to the Arctic that they wanted to get rid of, metaphorically. There, a lot of people thought I was looking to crash away up there, but it was all virtual. Nothing was left behind. But people sent remembrances of loved ones, or some terrible thing that happened to them that they wanted to forget, and I read it aloud to the cold and unforgiving north, and the wind took my words away and, metaphorically or virtually banished their problems or their secrets or whatever to the ice. And so.
Yeah, I can't turn my computer around to show you. I'll have to give you a little picture.
Oh, what's that?
But I keep your letter posted above my writing desk.
Oh, cool. Yeah. No, I mean, I really liked, it was originally just going to be a sort of one-off for that that project. But, now that I have, I have the domain, the Museum of Banishment, I kind of like it as a project and want to do something with it.
Right.
Going forward further, I'm not exactly sure what it'll be. But, yeah. So, cool.
I used it to hide the picture of Jonathan Franzen on the cover of Time that I, marked out and put pins through his eyes and things.
Oh, you're a really lovely guy.
Have Well, let's get down to it. We have an affinity for Ondaatje. Are we opposed on Franzen?
No, I don't. I mean, I don't like his writing. You're not a fan, right?
No,
I'm not. I
no.
mean, I'm not a fan of his writing. I just, we were living in Santa Cruz last year, and he divides his time between living in Santa Cruz, and so I just happen to know a bunch of people who, are friends of his, all of whom speak very highly of him as a human being. So that's all I meant. Yeah, I mean, I'm not a fan of his work, but he's, I'm sure, his mother loves him just the same as everybody else. So,
That's true.
yeah. So, what are you reading these days?
What am I reading? Well, I'm working on, because I have a bad habit of starting stuff and stopping and letting it sit for a long time. So after, I don't know, maybe a year of having the book, I'm finishing up Darren Dufresne's The Salt Palace.
Oh, okay.
And other than that, I'll just have to sort through the. I think I now officially have more books that I haven't read on my bookcases than I have read.
Yeah, I have to kind of go through periods where I kind of I keep myself from buying books so that I can force myself to read through the ones I already have and kind of work down the pile a little bit, and then I go out on another binge and buy a bunch more. So.
Yeah, that's really hard to do when my girlfriend is the inventory manager for a bookstore.
Yeah, that would make it a little bit more difficult. Yeah.
Because I might not ever go into the store, but every now and then I'll get an email or a phone call from someone at the store going, "Rebecca, put this book on hold for you."
Oh, great. Well,
Yeah,
that's
she thinks she might like it. And I was like, ah,
Yeah, somebody will get for you. Yeah. So.
right. But no, I've been. What have I got here? Oh, what about you? What's on the list besides the research?
I just gave up reading The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt, which is just unbearably bad, and I know many people who just rave about it, and I just don't get it. And I respect those people, and I'm sure they're good people, but good Lord, I could not get there with that book. So I read 450 pages into it, 770 pages, and I just I and I on the one hand, I didn't want to give up because I'd come so far, but I just couldn't go any further, and it was somewhat of a conundrum. It was just a little bit, quagmire Vietnam or something, but I finally walked away from it. So yeah, so I'm reading Adam Gopnik's book Winter right now, which seems fitting since since winter is coming and it's a new thing. So it's not a thing I've experienced in a meaningful way for the past 14 years. So I'm excited about that. So yeah.
Well, you certainly made more of an effort with Donna Tartt than I ever made with Franzen.
I finished the correction. I couldn't get more than maybe 100 or 200 pages into Freedom, but yeah, that's as far as I got with. And I read Donna Tartt's other two books, which were fine. The last one though, I read on an airplane. I wonder if I had been trapped somewhere, if I would have been able to finish The Goldfinch easier. But there was just without an external pressure, it was hard to go further.
Do you often find yourself getting in trouble with people because of your opinions about writers?
Probably. Sure. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've gotten better. I try not to be as needlessly hostile, but I don't have any problem saying, I don't think, Donna Tartt's book is particularly strong, even though I know a lot of people who really like it. And I'm fine having that conversation. And people talk endlessly about what a bad thing it is when they're when people shy away from doing negative reviews. And I feel like if you can't articulately describe the reason why you think an overhyped book is not a good book, then this is a problem. So. So yeah, so I'm generally okay. So yeah.
Yeah, my general opinion, because I know that that's been a big raging topic lately. And I find that, if the book isn't been already pre-hyped, and you're a critic and you don't like the book, just don't write the review.
Right.
I mean, that's my opinion. I mean, don't, because having been, I've been on all sides of the book thing. I've been a bookseller, been a writer, I've been the English major, unpublished writer fighting to defend my aesthetic, which is justifying my existence. And somebody at one point said, every writer is somebody's favorite writer. And it's, probably a good idea at times just to keep the snarky comments to yourself. And I don't have, but I don't think that, I think it was, there was an interview I read or an article I read a couple of years ago, somebody lamenting the fact that there weren't a lot of great literary throwdowns anymore, people really sniping and fighting with each other. And there was some quote from Gary Stettgart about how, well, all writers now have, these tenured professor jobs, and they are not willing to go out on a limb and fight with somebody because it might jeopardize, their health insurance and whatever. I just, and my response was, you fucking coward. And I think it's important to have arguments. I mean, my stance was always that if literature is so unimportant that people can't fight about it, then it's not worth picking up and reading. If it's going to matter, it's going to matter enough that people are going to want to argue about it.
Sure, yeah.
And I want literature to matter because that's justifies my existence.
Sure, yeah. No, absolutely.
And but I don't think it's, since every writer is eventually going to be somebody's favorite writer, I don't think that it's beneficial to, to attack and destroy the unknown writer, the first time writer.
Sure.
Let them find their audience and don't, because people can be swayed easily. Don't go out and destroy that writer before they have a chance.
Right.
On the other hand, somebody like Franzen, somebody like Donna Tartt, somebody like Stuttgart, somebody like oh, who's another big one that gets a lot of ridiculous hype right now? A Visit from the Goon Squad,
Oh,
lady,
Jennifer Egan, yeah.
Jennifer Egan.
Right.
I think that a that putting out a negative review for those type of people is beneficial to the literary landscape if it's done correctly. Shouldn't be a personal attack, but they should definitely go after the text if it's weak.
Right. I mean, yeah, I don't I you know, I had this whole sort of ethos of, I think that the first time writer, an unknown writer, one shouldn't write a negative review of it, just sort of let them go. And if it is, sort of an overhyped or sort of, blockbuster, then you almost have a duty to kind of, be as clear and articulate as possible, almost erring on the side of a negative review, just because there are so many other things you could be reading. I mean, for God's sakes, you don't have to read Harry Potter. But, sure enough, I mean, when I started actually reviewing books, and I thought, okay, well, I'm only going to write, positive reviews, or I'll just find another book that people should read instead. You found it a lot harder than it sounds. I mean,
Oh, yeah.
editors send you books to review, and a book is not good, and then the question is, what do I do with that? And so I've reviewed a couple of books that I really love, and I've reviewed some books where I didn't really love them, but I was able to sort of find something redeeming and or sort of recommend another book that's sort of more interesting or engaging in its place. And then there are a couple of books that I basically had to just tell the editor, I just, I wasn't going to review it because you know, it wasn't a strong book, and yet there was no real joy for me in writing a negative review. You know, it wasn't going to solve anything or do anything. It was
right.
going to, you know, just going to exist out there as a terrible, terrible, you know, terrible review of a terrible book. And so I just, you know, kind of, you know, passed on it. So, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, once you're a reviewer, you kind of have to make slightly different choices than you might otherwise.
Right.
Yeah. So, anyways, do you review books at all? Have you done any?
I've done a little bit for our local alternative paper, but I've just in the last months, about the time when I started the podcast, I shed all other responsibilities besides my day job working on the book and the podcast and its associated endeavor, the Eunoia Solstice thing. Felt like I was stretching myself too thin and was spending more time wrangling other contributors than actually doing what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
With the paper, so I stepped back. Which I'm not sure how I feel about that anymore. I mean, yeah, it frees up all this time, but my big complaint has always been that there aren't a lot of writers to talk to out here in Wichita.
Right.
And now that I'm not out there engaging them and trying to find them and get them to write reviews, I'm not in touch with any of them.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a problem because you need that community one way or another. So.
Yeah, but I'm talking to Darren Dufresne. He teaches at Wichita State. So,
cool.
But, you know, between the teaching and the family and writing, you know, it's maybe it's infrequent.
Yeah, right, right.
But I have the podcast now, so.
Cool. Yeah. One way of getting out there. Yeah.
Yeah. What else do we have to talk about? We have lots to talk about. What am I doing?
I don't know. What do you want? What? I don't know.
I don't know. So how's the job going? I mean, how's the teaching going?
It's going fine. It's going well. Yeah.
Have you been able to insert yourself in the literary community out there? Do you have enough? Sure.
Yeah, this is one of the things I do like about being in New York, is yeah, you don't have to go looking for the literary community. It's sort of, you know, it's out mm-hmm. and it's everywhere. And yeah, I mean, you know, when we were in Santa Cruz, it was much harder to do that. And, you know, I mean, kind of like a little bit what you're describing with Wichita, you really had to like work at it.
Right.
But here, you know, thankfully it's everywhere. So, so that part's been really great.
Have you at least waved at Emily?
Emily Mandel. No, we had dinner at Emily's house. Speaking of which,
oh, nice.
Owe her and her husband an invite over here. But, yeah. I've seen Emily. She seems to be doing well. Her book sounds great.
The one with Random House?
Yeah, the one that's coming out
Knopf.
Late next year, early 2015, I think.
Yeah.
So I think that will be really.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So.
Are you in Brooklyn or are you in some other?
We are in Brooklyn. Yeah, we're in Ditmas Park, which is not a particularly well-known part of Brooklyn. It's a little bit farther out. But it's quite nice. There's a lot of great old mansions around here, and there's some really great restaurants and stuff like that. So it doesn't have a bookstore, which is the one complaint about Ditmas Park. But hopefully, sometime soon, we'll get a bookstore.
There's one nearby. I'm sure.
Yeah, Park Slope. There's Community Books in Park Slope. That's probably the closest one. Still, you know,
there's a pretty good one down called Word.
Word is actually quite far from
where you're at.
Yeah, the thing about the subway system in Manhattan is it's well designed to get you from anywhere into Manhattan, and it's well designed yeah. from Manhattan to anywhere else. But it is not well designed to get from one part of Brooklyn to another part of Brooklyn, and so Word, which is in Greenpoint, is a much more substantial trek, even though it's in Brooklyn, than it would be to get to, you know, McNally Jackson or someplace that's in Manhattan proper. So it's one of the sort of quirks of the New York subway system. So
right.
So excited it is. So,
are you going to stay in New York over Christmas?
We'll probably go home to visit my parents. But yeah, are you going to be in Wichita? Are you guys going anywhere special?
Yeah, yeah. I was just curious because my mom and I went to, my sister lives in Jersey City and she works in Manhattan.
Oh, right.
And we went out there one Christmas and it was quite possibly the worst experience I ever had.
Really? Really? Why so?
Well, because all the New Yorkers leave New York over Christmas.
It's true.
And it's nothing but tourists. And my mom is, I love my mother.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get me wrong, but I hate traveling with her.
Yeah.
Because everything touristy to do, she wants to do.
Right, right.
And so we were up on Times Square or somewhere around in there, you know, like at Macy's and stuff, you know, the night before Christmas, you know, wall to wall people. I had a little freak out in the men's department at Macy's.
that sounds pretty bad.
I just can't stand. I mean, I don't mind being around a whole lot of people, but I don't like actually feeling them against my body.
Yeah. Right.
You know, what? A couple years later, I went to visit my sister and caught a New Order show at the Roseland Ballroom and didn't have a problem with New York then. I loved it for that trip because it was, you know, late October. There wasn't, it wasn't full of tourists and.
Right, right.
I wasn't under obligation to, like, you know, see important landmarks.
Yeah, no, it's much better once you can get beyond that. Yeah, so, yeah, that makes sense. So,
how? I know I have other things I want to ask. That's the problem. I'm still practicing, you know, being at a conversation. I'm not used to it.
It's weird. Yeah, I know. And also, it's been a while since I've done one of these myself. So, yeah, I'm sort of, yeah, it's weird. It's often sort of strangely forced, but it's going well.
Oh, how hideous. You know, I sit and I listen to other podcasts all the time, which kind of gave me the inspiration to do this. And I'm constantly disappointed with myself. It's terrible. But it's like I was telling Emily a couple weeks ago, you know, you learn by doing.
Right.
It's the best way to do it.
Right.
Oh well. So, I think we did okay.
Okay, cool. I guess it's been an hour, hasn't it? Yeah.
It's been about an hour. We managed to stretch it just a little bit.
No, that's good. Oh, well. Yeah. How many of these have you done now?
I have one in the can that's coming out next Monday. Yours will be 8. And then later today, I'm talking to Peter. I don't know how to pronounce his last name.
Peter Gay?
Yeah. The Lighthouse Road.
Oh, cool.
Originally.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll see.
Cool.
It's going to be a long day with headphones on.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, yeah. Then you should take a break. I don't know, give your ears some freedom. Well, cool. Well, I'm sorry that yesterday I screwed up or
failed. Oh, no, that, like I said, that was my fault. I should have gotten in touch with you on Friday to kind of, you know, confirm and everything. Oh, I know what I need to ask you. Have you lined up another publisher? Are you still with Unbridled? What's going on there?
I don't have anything to line up, so I don't at this point there's nothing definitive because there's no book per se, so I haven't gotten to that question yet, so I just don't know.
Right.
I guess we'll see how things go once it's once there's something to do, but
to do.
Yeah, exactly. I need to get on that, I guess. So,
well, good luck. Let me know if there's anything I can do to help. Not that I know a whole lot of people, but
oh, well, thanks. Well, yeah. And likewise, good luck with it. So yours is, it's revisioning or it's agenting or?
I'm kind of in that area where I could go either way. I could either revise some more I've tried one agent and didn't hear anything, and Stu Abraham has been offering to help with some recommendations on publishers and agents, and I can move forward with that. I'm just kind of, I have no confidence in the manuscript right now.
Oh, that's no good.
But I don't, I'm not doing it. I don't know how to fix it at the same time. So it's, I'm kind of at that point where I need someone to say, here's what's broken. Here's what you need to work on. Here's where you're failing. Here's what is working. And yeah, who knows? Well, thank you, Colin, for taking the time today.
Sure. Thanks for having me. Thanks for doing this. This is
No
fun.
problem.
Yeah, I guess if you do ever make it back out to New York, let me know.
Oh, well, planning to in the spring, I think.
Oh, cool. Okay, cool. Yeah. All right. So we'll figure something out
Sure.
later. Okay. We'll have to have you over. Pay back the dinner favor.
right. No problem.
We still talk really highly about that dinner. That was one of the highlights of the trip. So,
Oh,
yeah.
cool.
So.
Take care. All right, that was my conversation with Colin Dickey. Be sure to come back in 2 weeks when we have my conversation with the author of Safe from the Sea and The Lighthouse Road, Mr. Peter Guy.